He would go into the barracks at night, sit on the bed of his batman, Billy Gray, and talk soccer with the lads. He would bring his boots along and shine them as he talked. Private Wally Parr never got over the sight of a British lieutenant polishing his boots while his batman lay back on his bed, gassing on about Manchester United and West Ham and the other soccer teams. Everyone admired Din Brotheridge. He was fair, conscientious, hard-driving, quick to learn, a master at all the weapons in the company, an able teacher and an apt pupil, a natural leader. When Brotheridge was selected as leader of 1st Platoon, the other lieutenants in the company agreed that Din was the right man to lead the first troops to go into action on D-Day. He was among the best the country had produced to fight for its freedom in the life and death struggle. Brotheridge had more at stake in the struggle than most, for he was one of the few married men in D Company, and his wife, Margaret, was 8 months pregnant. So he had an unborn child's future on his mind during the flight over the English Channel. When Brotheridge began to dash across the bridge, the German garrison was sleeping at its post. But Private Helmut Rohmer's shout, the Luftpistol flare, and the firing by Brotheridge from his Sten gun all combined to wake the German troops. They manned their machine guns and got into the slit trenches on both sides of the bridge and began firing from their machine guns, their rifles, and their carbines. Brotheridge, almost across the bridge, his platoon following, the men firing from their hips, pulled a grenade out of his pouch and threw it at the machine gun pit to his right. As he threw the grenade, he was knocked over by the impact of a bullet in his neck. He fell forward. His platoon ran past him, with two other platoons from two other gliders close behind. The men of D Company cleared out the machine gun pits and the slit trenches in short order. By 0021 hours, 5 minutes after the assault began, the enemy in the immediate vicinity of the bridge had either been killed or had run off. Private Wally Parr went looking for Brotheridge, who was supposed to set up his command post at a cafe beside the bridge. He found Brotheridge lying on the ground in the road opposite the cafe. His eyes were open and his lips were moving, but Parr could not make out what he was saying. Parr thought, what a waste. All the years of training we put in to do this job, it lasted only seconds, and there he lies. Stretcher bearers carried Brotheridge back across the bridge to an aid station. The company doctor, John Vaughn, found the wounded lieutenant. Vaughn said he was laying on his back, looking up at the stars and looking terribly surprised, just surprised. Vaughn gave Brotheridge a shot of morphine and began to dress the bullet hole in the middle of his neck. Before he could complete the first aid, Brotheridge died. He was the first Allied soldier to be killed by enemy fire on D-Day. Midnight, the start of D-Day. Lieutenant Robert Mason Mathias was riding in a C-47 Dakota over the English Channel, headed toward the Cotentin Peninsula of Normandy. Mathias was the leader of the 2nd Platoon, E Company, 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment, U.S. 82nd Airborne Division. 2 hours later, the plane was over France and starting to take some flak from German guns. At 2:27, Mathias saw the red light go on over the open door of the plane, the signal to get ready. He hooked the clip from his parachute to the static line running down the middle of the roof of the aircraft. Mathias called out to the 16 men behind him, "Stand up and hook up!" He stepped to the open door, ready to jump the instant the pilot decided the plane was over the drop zone and turned on the green light. From below, the Germans were firing furiously at the air armada of 822 C-47s carrying the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions into battle. 20-millimeter four-barreled anti-aircraft guns filled the sky with explosions. Machine gun tracers, green, yellow, red, blue, white, arched through the sky. The sight was awesome. Nearly every paratrooper thought this was the grandest 4th of July fireworks display he had ever seen. And the sight was terrifying. For every visible tracer, there were 5 unseen bullets. Unseen but not unheard, the bullets rattled against the wings of the C-47s, sounding like rocks being shaken in a tin can. Flying at less than 1,000 feet and slower than 120 miles per hour, the planes made easy targets. Looking out the door, Lieutenant Mathias could see an intense fire raging. A hay barn on the edge of the village of St. Mariglise had caught fire, probably from a spent tracer, and was burning fiercely, illuminating the horizon. The pilot was attempting to escape the flak by turning first this way and then that, spilling the men. Those behind Mathias were calling out, "Let's go! For Christ's sake, let's go! Jump, damn it, jump!" As machine gun bullets came up through the fuselage, the men instinctively put their hands over their crotches. They had made a dozen or more practice jumps. Never had it occurred to them that they would be so eager to get out of an airplane in flight. Mathias had his hands on the outside of the doorway, ready to propel himself into the night the instant the green light went on. A shell burst just beside him. Red-hot flak ripped through his reserve chute, into his chest, knocking him off his feet. But with a mighty effort, he began to pull himself back. The green light went on. He regained his feet and got back to his post at the door. That was the kind of action his men had learned to expect from Bob Mathias. Long and lanky, 6'1", 175 pounds, he was in superb condition, all raw bone and muscle, strong enough to survive a blow that would have felled an ox, and to recover almost instantly. At 28 years of age, Mathias was 5 or so years older than the other lieutenants in the 508th, and he was immensely popular with his platoon and fellow officers. For 2 years, he had been preparing himself and his platoon for this moment. He was known to be absolutely fair and totally dedicated. He was the best boxer in the regiment and the best marcher. On one 25-mile march, when everyone was pushing to the limit, one of his men gave out. Mathias picked him up and carried him the last 3/4 of a mile home. Mathias was a devout Catholic. He went to Mass as often as possible and did all he could to make church attendance convenient for his men. He never swore. His company commander said of him, "He can more than hold his own with the toughest man alive, yet you won't ever hear him use hell or damn." When a man in the second platoon had a problem, Mathias could sense it. He would discreetly offer his counsel, but he never intruded. One of his privates said of him, "He made allowances, but he never compromised his standards. He seemed deeply hurt on the few occasions we failed to meet his expectations, but he never lost his temper." Mathias had prepared himself in every way possible for the upcoming struggle. He was a student of military history. He had mastered every weapon and skill necessary to a rifle company. He had studied German weapons, organization, and tactics. He had learned the German language well enough to speak it fluently. And he had learned enough French to ask directions. He had taught his men German commands and French phrases. Colonel Roy Lindquist, commanding the 508th, said of Mathias, "He will either earn the Medal of Honor or be the first 508th man killed in action." At the airfield on the evening of June 5, as the 508th loaded up for the crossing of the channel, Mathias had shaken hands with each member of his platoon. The platoon was being carried in 2 planes. Private Cavanaugh, who was in the other stick, recalled, "There was an air of deserved confidence about this grand fellow. We shook hands and he said to me, 'We'll show him, won't we, Irish?'" When Mathias was wounded from the shell burst and the green light went on, he could have pushed himself out of the way so that the men behind him could jump. Had he done so, the crew of the C-47 could have applied first aid and, quite possibly, gotten him back to England in time for a life-saving operation. Later, every man in that plane was certain that Matthias must have had that thought. Instead, Matthias raised his right arm, called out, "Follow me!" and leaped into the night. Whether the shock from the opening parachute, or the shock of hitting the ground, or excessive bleeding from his multiple wounds was the cause, no one knows. But when Bob Matthias was located a half hour or so later, he was still in his chute, dead. He was the first American officer killed by German fire on D-Day. Operation Overlord, the invasion of German-occupied France in June 1944, was staggering in its scope. In one night and day, 175,000 fighting men and their equipment, including 50,000 vehicles of all types, ranging from motorcycles to tanks and armored bulldozers, were transported across 60 to 100 miles of open water and landed on a hostile shore against intense opposition. They were either carried by or supported by 5,333 ships and craft of all types and almost 11,000 airplanes. They came from southwestern England, southern England, the east coast of England. It was as if the cities of Green Bay, Racine, and Kenosha, Wisconsin, were picked up and moved, every man, woman, and child, every automobile and truck, to the east side of Lake Michigan in one night. The effort behind this unique movement, which British Prime Minister Winston S. Churchill rightly called the most difficult and complicated operation ever to take place, stretched back 2 years in time and involved the efforts of literally millions of people. The production figures from the United States in landing craft, ships of war, airplanes of all types, weapons, medicine, and so much more were fantastic. The figures in the United Kingdom and Canada were similar. But for all that American industrial brawn and organizational ability could do, for all that the British and Canadians and other allies could contribute, for all the plans and preparations, for all the brilliance of the generals, in the end, success or failure in Operation Overlord came down to a relatively small number of junior officers, non-coms, and privates, or seamen, in the American, British, and Canadian armies, navies, air forces, and coast guards. If the paratroopers and glider-borne troops cowered behind hedgerows, or hid out in barns, rather than actively seeking out the enemy, if the coxswains did not drive their landing craft ashore, but instead, out of fear of enemy fire, dropped the ramps in too deep water, if the men at the beaches dug in behind the seawall, if the non-coms and junior officers failed to lead their men up and over the seawall to move inland in the face of enemy fire, why then the most thoroughly planned offensive in military history, an offensive supported by incredible amounts of naval firepower, bombs, and rockets, would fail. It all came down to a bunch of 18 to 28-year-olds. They were magnificently trained and equipped and supported, but only a few of them had ever been in combat. Only a few had ever killed or seen a buddy killed. Most were like Den Brotheridge or Bob Matthias. They had never heard a shot fired in anger. They were citizen soldiers, not professionals. Toward the end of spring 1944, it was an open question as to whether a democracy could produce young soldiers capable of fighting effectively against the best that Nazi Germany could produce. Hitler was certain that the answer was no. Nothing caused him to doubt that on anything approaching equality in numbers, the Wehrmacht, the German army, would prevail. Totalitarian fanaticism and discipline would always conquer democratic liberalism and softness. Of that, Hitler was sure. If Hitler had seen Den Brotheridge and Bob Matthias in action at the beginning of D-Day, he might have had second thoughts. It's Brotheridge and Matthias and their buddies, the young men born into the false prosperity of the 1920s and brought up in the bitter realities of the Depression of the 1930s that this story is about. The literature they read as youngsters was anti-war, cynical, portraying patriots as suckers, slackers as heroes.